Okay, great. Right. So let's get started. So I'm happy to welcome our speaker today, Karan Jani from Vanderbilt University. Karan got his PhD in 2017 from Georgia Tech. Then he did a postdoc at the same institution before moving to Vanderbilt in 2019, where he's been ever since. So Karan is a member of the LIGO collaboration. And much of his work, is related to the discovery and the study of gravitational wave sources. And so today, he'll be telling us about a particularly interesting gravitational wave source, GW190521. And so, Karan, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Well, thank you, Neil and Nayesh, for inviting me here, virtually hosting me here at the Perimeter Institute. It's an always a true honor to be here at the Institute. So I'm going to speak about this newest of the black hole discoveries from LIGO. Binary black holes is a sort of a traditional thing now that LIGO keeps seeing. But this one is really, it's sort of pushed our understanding both in terms of, astrophysical sources that we expect in gravitational waves, but as well really the interpretation of it that is that's still fairly puzzling. This is a very evolving event in the sense that you will see new papers on archive almost on a daily basis saying an interpretation of the event in a way that is slightly different than the one that was published from our side as the LIGO Virgo collaboration. So for most of the part of this talk, I would rather focus on the paper that I and my colleagues have written and, what sort of rationale went behind in our analysis. And the rooms are still fairly open so that, new open studies about this can be clocked in. Those, seeing the sort of GW tag for the first time, I mean, for every gravitational wave we have, we go by the date when it has arrived. So GW190521 is May 21st, 2019. The signal arrived that day on the Earth. And the visual that you see behind is actually the, what you call the space-time ripples that are emitted during the time when the two black holes are sort of inspiring and collide. This is a 2D representation of what popularly we call the space-time ripples. Now, I've been as Neil said, I've been involved with LIGO for a while, but even before I've been working on gravitational waves for since almost my undergrad. I was actually at the Perimeter Institute for all of my junior year summer. I was in the group of Professor Lee Smolin working on quantum gravity phenomenology using gravitational waves. This is one of the talks in Pearsa that you can still see and find. It's speaking about, this in-spiral merger ring down, and especially the ring down part where we can test, quantum phenomena. I'm happy that this is still is something related that I'm working on. That summer, Professor Stephen Hawking was also at the Institute, and here's a picture from the Black Hole Bistro that I truly enjoyed during the time that I was at the Perimeter Institute. So yeah, so this is my contribution to social media meme of where how's it going and how it started. Okay, so in terms of the outline today, one, I'll spend a good time on explaining what makes this discovery so unique from the distribution that we have seen so far, the parameters that we have seen so far. I'll divide it roughly in three parts. I'll pause at each part so that we can have a discussion during that pauses. The second focus is, I'll sort of brush on the what we think is consistency with general relativity is, what we feel from the astrophysical population, if something is really sort of clicking different for this kind of sources than what other vanilla binary black hole sources we have seen. Especially the implications also to cosmology, because these events are really, at cosmological redshifts, what the detectors can see at this moment. And almost half of my talk later, I want to speak about the science case for next generation experiment, what happens after LIGO and how this particular source really connects, the entire thread of gravitational wave astronomy that we intend to do for the next 20 years. So, okay, starting then. This is a particularly interesting time, right, for studying black holes, because after a long wait, we are now in an era where we have observations, measurements of black holes. And by measurement of black holes, I particularly mean that we have some level of probing the space-time metric around these objects. We are almost sort of equaling a revolution that in astrophysics is comparable perhaps to exoplanets, or in fundamental physics is, you know, how we kept sort of discovering new subatomic particles. The goal is somewhat similar here, that we want to understand the extreme gravity around the black holes and perhaps probe a new physics. So in this last 5 years, it has been quite a run. In 2015, LIGO makes the first discovery of gravitational waves. This is the first gravitational wave signal, GW150914, arrived on September 14, 2015. This is the morphology of the gravitational wave in time domain. And the backdrop you see is what we call the time frequency map. And the heat map that you see is the energy that is recorded. And a particular signal of what a gravitational wave is this sort of increasing frequency as a function of time, which we call chirp. So it has this sort of a chirp sound if we were to convert into audible range. But this is one of our, you know, first gravitational wave event. Following since, you know, we've had this pretty picture now from the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration of the M87. And then we also have over the years, much before both of this, the understanding of the central black hole of our galaxy. All of this, you know, is in different mass scales of black holes, but the cuteness of GR being, you know, it's almost indifferent to what mass the black hole is. The behavior of the space-time is going to be the same. Now, I hope it's not sort of controversial in saying this, that, you know, what LIGO essentially sees is the most direct insight into the event horizons. You know, when we detect these gravitational waves, especially during the time when the two black holes are colliding, we see in real time almost the dynamical horizon. See that there are two event horizons, they smudged into some sort of a deformed event horizon, and then over the time it's relaxing to become almost a curved black hole. And that kind of a direct imprint is almost sort of, you know, it's uncorrupted whenever we receive the signal. It's only a matter of fact that, you know, how well we are able to infer what the horizon shapes were. And we typically do it as a function of mass and the spins of the two black holes. The process from electromagnetism, you know, even though we do study, you know, the properties of the black hole space-time, it's indirect in the sense we need something beyond just the space-time to sort of infer us what is happening. So in the case of the picture, we rely on the behavior of gas. In the cases of following the dynamics, you know, we don't really see the black hole, but we are relying on, you know, whether we have model the stars and their motions fairly well. And the same holds true even for X-ray binaries, where there is a more sort of systematics about accretion. So the fact that now we have this machinery finally to get a peek inside how the event horizons are behaving, over the course of 2015 to 2017, which had two observing runs of LIGO, we have seen 11 gravitational wave events, out of which 10 of them are mergers of two black holes, and one of them is this famous neutron star collision that was jointly detected with electromagnetic telescopes. A starting feature here is, you know, see a different morphology of the waves, you know, but roughly all of the signals are about close to half a second. That is like the maximum sort of size of a binary black hole that we see, compared to if you see with neutron star, it is in orders of minutes. As big the black hole gets, the size of the gravitational wave of time domain that we see is smaller. That has to do with the frequency that LIGO is audible. You know, these black holes are merging for millions of years. We get to capture only a certain frequency, and the frequency of gravitational wave scales inversely with the mass of the compact objects that is colliding. So the heavier the black hole is, those signals are even shorter. So one classic example, if you want to compare, is the first detection. You can see a number of few cycles here compared to the third detection, which was much lighter. You can see a lot more number of cycles that is in band. And up until our end of the second observing run, this was one of the shortest runs that we had seen, which happened in July of 2017. It's roughly corresponding to 90 solar mass. But you can see there's a sort of wide morphology that we can study over the time. We restarted after ending the run in 2017. LIGO restarted in April of 2019. And this is our third observing run. There is always this year long or so break. It's very similar to, if you want to have an analogy to, you know, how the accelerators are. We collect data, then we pause for upgrades. And those upgrades increase our sensitivity to the universe. And then we sort of resume, the number of events that we see just suddenly scales up because now we can see a bigger volume of the universe. So we restarted in April. The run was supposed to end this past summer, but just like COVID and everything else, the run got ended earlier prematurely at the start of the spring semester. But during the time, we had enough events, you know, to really dive into the new sort of exciting studies that we can do. On May 21st, 2019, there was so a signal that was received. Now, every time LIGO receives a signal, we send it almost in a few minutes, a real time. It's an automated pipeline that sends an alert. If you have signed up on the LIGO alerts, there is an app. So you can go to the website and sign up for emails, text messages. You'll get like within a few minutes, you know, what the stage of the analysis is. So on May 21st, we send out a signal to the astronomers that, look, we have seen something interesting. We don't reveal typically what masses that we have seen. What we reveal is one primary thing is the sky map, you know, where in the sky the signal came from. We also release the distance, you know, so you get a sort of sense of a 3D sort of ellipsoid within which this source would be lying. And we give a classification of, you know, what is the probability that this is a binary black hole, this is a binary neutron star, a neutron star black hole, just in that regards. Now, typically, if it's a binary black hole, which was in this case, it's not really exciting to follow up because for most practical purpose, we don't expect astrophysical binary black holes, especially the stellar sized, to have much counterparts. But there is a sweet twist in this particular case. And I'm happy to, you know, I'll chat about it in the coming slides. So around this time last year, we started, you know, the collaboration appoints a team. We start writing a paper about this discovery. We had sort of enough science case, you know, that what we had seen is so exceptional, it deserves, you know, special publication by itself. As you can see from the time that we saw till the time we made release, it's almost 15 months. This is one of the longest wait we have had in publishing the gravitational wave event. We had a press conference on September 2nd. When we started writing, the idea was that we're going to have this NSF press conference in Washington, D.C. announcing, but well, as the time is, we announced it over the Zoom call to the press. Here are my colleagues from the Virgo collaboration. At the time of release, I was representing the LIGO Scientific collaboration. We published two papers that day. One appeared in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. The another appeared in the Physical Review Letters, both talking about, you know, as much analysis as we have done over the event. Now, the question is why it's delayed so much. And one reason is obviously is the pandemic. But the second is the level of scrutiny that it requires us before making this claim, especially for a signal of this nature, was much more thorough than we have seen in past. And that is why it's also not surprising that, you know, independent analysis by people right now, you know, that papers come on archive, you can find more and more inference and give statistical significance to one formation over the other. But if you had to really sort of, you know, summarize what this discovery is in a line, and that's what I've stolen for my title. It was this cover of New York Times on the day after or day of our release. And it said that these black holes should not exist, but there they are. I'm glad for a change that Times actually used a numerical relativity simulation of the binary black hole instead of this typical picture of light bending around the black holes, that is not what we observe. We don't even see gas around the black holes. What we really observe is the space-time ripples. Here, the black line that you see is the best matching solutions to Einstein's field equation that we get for solving a two-body problem that matches with the data. The red sort of line, this waves coming out is what you call typically gravitational waves. And just for comparison, you can see how small the event horizons are when you sort of look at it in, from a distance. So coming to this now, the physics of the signal, this is the shortest signal we had seen so far from everything else. So across this years of gravitational wave astronomy, the total signal size, the science data really, is only about 0.1 seconds. And that by mean, I mean, you know, the things that look wiggly enough that there is actual data and not something which is just looking like background noise. So roughly we see four cycles. Here is a time domain reconstruction of what the signal is based on our algorithms. And the orange line is, you know, the best matching solutions to Einstein's field equations. Now, first pause, you see a signal, and for the, and if you're not used to sort of gravitational wave data analysis, it almost looks like a sine Gaussian, right, that we are seeing. But we can confirm that just based on this this detection, this event being seen in three detectors, LIGO Hanford, LIGO Livingston, and Virgo detector in Italy, the false alarm rate that this is a terrestrial glitch versus it's an astrophysical signal is 1 in 5,000 years. So we are very confident that the signal is astrophysical origin, say to speak. Now, when you look at the same signal in this frequency time domain, it does not really look like a chirp. It looks like this burst, right? There's this one point, there's a frequency in time, you just have sort of a flash that you got captured. So the way we found the signal, at least with the highest significance, was with a search we call an unmodeled burst search. It searches for this transient burst instead of, you know, and it can find chirp patterns as well, but it's more successful in finding this kind of a burst. It is oblivion to the modeling, so it doesn't matter if it was a supernova or whether it was an intermediate mass black hole, it can catch that. But it happens to be extremely powerful in searching for intermediate mass black holes. Because as I said, you know, the heavier the mass of the black hole, the smaller the signal, so you're only really seeing is the burst. We had trained this search for, you know, and we've been running it for a long time. Most of my PhD thesis was to develop this search in context of LIGO. I led two papers that the collaboration had published for the search of intermediate mass black hole. One was for the first observing run, and then again in the second observing run. So far, we have not seen any signal with total mass greater than 100 solar masses of the black holes up until this signal arrived. And so we can give a statistics of what is the chance that the universe makes, you know, what is the merger rate density of this. And it comes down to be 1 every 8 years in a cubic gigaparsec volume. That's a very, very small number. It's a rare catch. It's consistent with our upper limit. So if you see our 2017-18 papers, we expected if around 150 solar mass binary exists, this is roughly what the upper limits of the system is going to be. And we find it's decently consistent with it. On that very day, we actually caught two signals that were only 4 hours apart. There were the speculations, can it be coming from the same source? You know, can it be sort of strongly lensed, et cetera? But we looked into it and there is no real consistency of them being the same. We have just reached a point in gravitational wave astronomy where we are going to see multiple events every day. And it's just it's a crazy good feeling to be there, especially if you've been in the field 15 years and now you can finally have more events than the on the same day, actually. We then did this Bayesian inference of what the parameters of the system are.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
The second event detected that day, was it also in this very odd mass range, or was it a sort of more standard event?
It's not released publicly yet, that information.
Okay.
It will be released soon, but I can tell you that there is not overlap of sky maps, at least.
Uh-huh. Could I ask another question while I'm at it? You mentioned it was detected in all three detectors. How strongly was it seen in the three different detectors?
It was seen strongest in Livingston, which is the most sensitive detector at the low frequency that we have. And Virgo sees it with, doesn't see it with a very high signal to noise. So the combined signal to noise ratio for all this comes to about 15.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
So we did this then after, inferring. This is a standard parameter estimation machinery that we apply to infer what the system is, assuming it is a circular binary black hole merger. And I'll stress a little later on why I, say this has to be, our assumption is a circular binary black hole merger. We use three distinct state-of-the-art general relativity signal models of binary black hole coalescence. So these models are essentially, starts with the different physics approximations at the time when the two black holes are far apart. And then once they are sort of coming close, they are tuned to numerical relativity simulations. And then accordingly, they predict the ring down as well. So it has this whole evolution of binary black hole system generically for any spin configuration that you want within a certain level of mass ratio. So they're really evolved models in that sense. We further compared it with around 3,000 numerical relativity simulations of binary black hole mergers. As many of you are here involved at Perimeter Institute as well with these things, these are ridiculously time-consuming, computationally extensive simulations of 50,000 computing hours per simulation it can take. The very fact that we had multiple groups releasing catalogs that are accessible to now LIGO-Virgo collaboration. So we really take directly the simulation data with the modes and everything combined, and we compare it with the data. And then we rank which simulation is most matching with the signal that we have seen. Doing this entire consistency check, which after being in multiple different waveform models and numerical simulations, we can confirm that both primary and secondary black holes are heavier than any previous gravitational wave binary that we have seen. The plot here on the left shows the mass of the x-axis is the mass of the heavier black hole, the y-axis is the mass of the smaller black hole. Each contour line refers to these three waveform models that we have used. The one particularly that we quote as our most reliable model for this, this analysis is this purple line. For reference, all your LIGO-Virgo black holes that we have seen before are within this triangle, are inside that. So you can just see a sense of scale, how different the system is compared to everything else you have seen. The another point is the contours are much broader than what we typically see in gravitational wave events that we have seen in past. And that has to do with the fact that we see such tiny in spiral. In fact, what we've really essentially seen is only an instance before which a common event horizon has formed above the two black holes that has been sort of captured, and that black hole is relaxing. So our distribution of the masses is fairly broad. What we quote in abstracts, in press releases, in a lot of various, is these two numbers that the bigger black hole is about 85 solar mass, the smaller black hole is about 66 solar mass. But the actual 90% confidence is this whole thing that you see here, blob. So if you have a model that predicts that no, black holes cannot be less than 100 solar masses, or if you have them, they have to be less than 60 solar masses, both of those things are consistent with the data. It's just the median values of the posterior matches this number that we have seen. The merger of these two black holes is slightly more robust. That number comes to around 150 solar mass, and it's spinning at 70% of its theoretical maximum level. Now, as soon as we saw the primary black hole mass, and this was more obvious even when we had the first inference of what the system is, even if you look at just the morphology and you know if it's a binary black hole, you can already infer the approximate total mass of the system. And if it's an equal mass system, even in that simplest case, the black holes are in what you call is the pair instability supernova mass gap. So if you have the starting point as a progenitor that all black holes are coming from core collapse supernovae, then there is a point during which the star is just the right size where there is a softening of the equation of state. It has this pair production that happens at the core. It completely blasts off the star, and you'd be not left with any product at the end. Now, this is not a tightly understood phenomena as a Chandrasekhar mass in comparison. So it's roughly predicted that somewhere from 60 to 120 solar mass of the component black hole that is left, we would not have any direct astrophysical channel for it. So here's a bit crowded plot. So let me run through this. The x-axis here is the mass of your zero age main sequence star, the progenitor. The y-axis is what is left as a compact object. And I'm only plotted here things which are above, you know, five solar mass. There is another mass gap that happens at the lower end. We will ignore it for now here. If you start with a 25 solar mass star, you will come with a five solar mass black hole. If you increase the mass of the star, and depending on what metallicity you had, you could come up with a black hole that can be 50 solar mass, or it could be as small as 20 solar mass at, you know, zero age main sequence star of 50. But after a point, you know, no matter what metallicity you use, and this is, of course, we are relying on population synthesis models that try to capture this pair instability supernovae scenario. Between a certain masses of zero age main sequence star, you may be left with a component object or you may not be left with a component object. But in either cases, that object cannot be in the range of 60 to 120. Now, on the left panel here, what we have plotted is the heaviest black holes that LIGO has seen, the rightmost being this particular event, GW190521. Now, if I take this, you know, whatever gap, you know, some models predict it can start at 55, some predict it can start at 70. So it's fairly uncertain mass gap here. But if we take that uncertainty into account, the primary black hole is almost 100% in the gap. It has a very little chance of being outside the gap for at least one of the GR models that we have used. The secondary black hole could be outside the gap depending on, you know, how small mass the gap actually starts. The two blacks here are referring to the bigger and the smaller black holes for all LIGO events. The triangles are what is formed as a merger, as the one after the two black holes have merged. So you can see that the mass of the primary black hole in this particular case is not very far from the heaviest merged black hole that we have seen. So it is possible that what we are essentially catching is a some sort of a hierarchical binary black hole merger, that these black holes don't come from stars. They are merged black holes that tend to find another black hole. And that is what we have started to see. I'll speak a little later on, you know, it's unlikely because of many astrophysical reasons, but that is a start that this could be, that this is a way to produce the masses.
So can you comment on those curves, you know, that you showed, like, you know, so how are these computed? Like, you know, so are these based off of like 1D calculations or are these like multidimensional simulations? You know?
This is a series of population synthesis models that that different groups have provided to us during the time of writing. So it's their model predicts it. I don't know if they have any sophisticated way of, you know, going through the supernova calculation. I don't think they include any numerical relativity recipe in producing this. This is based mostly on nuclear rates and calculations of that nature of the core.
Okay. Like, is it obvious, you know, why the metallicity has this, like this effect, for example?
Yeah, so, I mean, I can give you rough, I have only rough understanding from the astrophysical side. So in the sense, if we had this very low metallicity pop three stars, they would be leaving remnant black holes, which are decently big. But if they are, you know, this newer stars, which are more metallic, then the core is typically not as heavy. I don't know if anyone else from the call wants to chime in on that.
Like, I'm just wondering, I'm just wondering how seriously I should, you know, be worried about this or not, right?
Yeah, so I'll tell you one thing, which is it's definitely missing here. So all of this assumes a single star calculation. And supposing the stars are formed as binary and there is a mass transfer that allows you to prevent this gap. Let's say it's going through the supernova and suddenly there is, you know, this mass transfer that sort of acts on it. There is ways to fudge it. This is clearly the lesser understood side of this whole analysis. But the LIGO inference is independent. I'm saying from the astrophysical side, this is a little less understood.
Oh, right. You know, but the claim that these things shouldn't exist is based off of these curves. And so I'm just wondering, how robust are these curves?
Yes, yes. So one of the things that what we are able to provide is some sense of, where does the gap start? You know, that is something what gravitational wave observations can prove. Provided, if we see this distribution of masses that we have seen in black holes, and suddenly there are this gap where we don't see black holes, that may mean there is a gap, but it is much heavier than what the models had predicted before.
So the existence of a gap somewhere, you're saying, is robust, but its location maybe isn't so robust.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great.
Isn't it true that the your red stripe there is not to do with metallicity, it's to do with pair production inside the core and removing radiation support for the stars?
Yes, that's right. So this is completely based on the fact that there is a PISN production there. The metallicity is just here to say that, even in this range where a high metallicity, low metallicity star would not leave a compact object. The high metallicity star may leave, but not as heavy as this one. So yes, this gap is their default of whatever the star we start with.
And since you've been stopped, can I ask you the mechanism that kicks into the far right, the blue line that starts at 200 and climbs, what's that mechanism?
From my limited understanding of this is once we reach a certain mass that even the pair in production that would not be able to blow off the star, you can still compress and form a bigger black hole. So you could still have formed black holes outside the gap.
I see. Thank you.
Can I make a comment too? Another way of producing black holes is through direct collapse of a star. And the most massive star we know of observations is 168,000 light years away, population 3 star, with a mass of 300 solar masses, roughly. But again, when you do the analysis through years of research, it's not possible to produce a black hole bigger than, say, 56 solar mass, you get the same answer. I think this should be taken seriously because it's based on a lot of years of analysis of all this.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, just to follow up on, what's on Cliff's question, so on the right, you're saying, that the black holes form again because the pair instability doesn't happen? It happens, I guess you're saying, but it leads just to an implosion without any explosion? Is it?
You mean here somewhere?
Yeah.
So it still would go through some explosion, but the amount of, so beyond this certain size, we can still have, from the stellar models, no matter how sort of physics they capture, and we are able to form the black holes. And in that case, it is more 1-to-1, yes, whatever the zero age mean sequence star was and what is left as the compact object.
Just one other comment. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary experimental verification. So in experimental physics, you need more than one event, back to the earlier question. So if we see more than one event, hopefully 2 or 3 events, then we can be sure that the result isn't just some model-dependent analysis activity going on.
Yes, and actually, I will, John, speak a little about that. We have seen other events, not as, and they roughly have the same sort of mass distribution. And these are the ones that we have published. Actually, there is a catalog coming out very soon, and there will be more interesting events that we can ponder about this.
Is it as convincing as the first event? You can't say that yet.
Yes, yes. So that is true, yes. So, and the astrophysical rates are sort of matching up, that there is a rarer population like this. no more questions here, I'll go ahead. Okay, so another thing that we can infer beyond the masses, which is the most, you know, of course, the astounding thing about this discovery, regardless of, you know, how this masses, you know, what they correspond to, the fact from gravitational wave side, you know, we have this sort of robust understanding of those. The second is, you know, that is coupled with the spins of how these black holes are spinning. We get a mild but consistent evidence that the binary black holes just before the merger exhibited spin orbit precession. So if you look at the plot on the left here, these are the spin projection of the two black holes by the time, you know, LIGO captured them. You can see there is this inference that both the spins are roughly perpendicular to the orbital angular momentum axis. So if we were had to start, let's say the black holes have formed, there were binary progenitor stars, both went through some level of supernova, avoided mass gap somehow. In that kind of a scenario, we'll see more likely that the orbital angular momentum and the spins of the star is aligned dynamically. But what we here see is more consistent with the fact that these two black holes have been captured, so they can be really have any generic spin distribution. We just happen to catch this particular instance. And mind that this is not the most observationally selective thing, because gravitational waves are released more if the spins are aligned with the angular momentum. So in fact, we do see those systems farther away. The fact we capture something in this generic side means there is a astrophysical channel that it exhibits. We looked at the fact what if the system has no spins. So we start with our models without any spins that the two black holes don't have. We find light evidence that no black holes have to be spinning. They cannot be non-spinning. Again, consistent with astrophysical interpretation, but just to see what the data supports. We also kept our black hole spin sort of fixed project aligned with the momentum axis, but that has even less support for the data. We find that there is more evidence that the black holes have to be precessing. Now, the fact that we only see a 0.1 second of signal with even a 1/5 of that part really being the two individual black hole spins, and are still able to see this level of details about the horizon is really the testimony of gravitational wave data analysis, right? I mean, this same event in future detectors that I'll speak is much longer, and we'll be able to know precisely where this spin is and how it actually evolved as a function of time. Here, we can only see a snapshot of what the system was. This is also the farthest gravitational wave event we have seen. The redshift that it corresponds to is roughly, you know, 0.5 to 1. It's almost over half the age of the universe. Just like any astrophysical binary, there is a degeneracy between the distance and the inclination of the orbit with respect to the observer. We were able to break that degeneracy in this particular case because our models use what we call this radiation beyond the quadrupolar term. So we get this off-axis, you know, radiation from gravitational waves. Our models include that. For at least three of the two models, we were able to break that degeneracy, and we get the system is roughly around 5.5 to 6 gigaparsec away, and it has almost a face on from us as an observer. That one of the models, however, was not able to break the degeneracy. It finds that the event is, you know, doesn't break it, so it finds the event is within 90% confidence is actually slightly closer to us than what we infer for the other two models. Now, the reason I stress here is for two points. One is gravitational wave analysis does not give you redshift. It gives you luminosity distance. So we infer the redshift, assuming a certain cosmology. And from there, then we get the mass in the astrophysical frame. So if the system is close to us, then the redshift is less. So the mass in the source frame is actually much heavier. And in that way, there is this sort of slight room of making the black hole go one way over the gap or the other way over the gap, depending on what, you know, model that we prefer. But the more prominent reason here is that there was an electromagnetic counterpart that was claimed by the Zwicky Transit Factory group at Caltech and elsewhere, that they saw an AGN flare a few weeks after LIGO's sky map, so May 21st, 2019, a few weeks after the same part in sky, they saw an a UV flare. Their claim is the UV flare is associated with this LIGO event. The AGN that it came from, so it's it has come from an AGN disk. Their claim is the black holes have formed in the AGN disk. And after the merger, the black hole was kicked. It was traveling. It released a gas. And the AGN that they find is at 2.5 gigaparsec. Now, that is much closer than what the gravitational wave data analysis from our side infers the distance to the source. But at least one of the model does not rule out. So there is still mild support, even if very unlikely, that there could have been an AGN candidate with this study. Any questions
here? Yeah, actually, I had a question. So can you describe what these models are? So should I think of these just as different ways to interpolate between like simulation results?
So we start, let's say we have this two-body problem of GRs. We start with two black holes far apart. In the early in spiral, we can have a post-Newtonian approximation of how they're going to evolve once they come into this strong gravity regime. One of the models, it's the Phenom model here, is tuned to numerical relativity simulations and what the merger is predicted. And then the ring down again is based on analytical calculations. So it tries to sort of stitch the three parts and creates a waveform model. So you give any initial data, masses and the spins of black hole, it will compute the gravitational wave morphology for you. These three different models have sort of a different starting point. The one that we trust in this particular case the most is a numerical relativity surrogate model. So it is based on this numerical relativity simulation banks and a surrogate that has been built on top of it. So it has really the least assumption in terms of modeling. It's only relying on the placement of the bank. The green model is this effective one-body model. It treats it as a one effective one potential instead of two black holes, predicts what the in-spiral merger and ring down has to be. It's more robust. It works for all masses, mass ranges. But that's as much as I can sort of comment on the waveform models. All three of them are extremely accurate with solutions at different parts in the parameter space. And all of them also differ equally in different parts of parameter space.
Okay, so it's not just, it's not just some fitting function to the simulations. I see, some actual physics goes into it as well. Okay.
Yes. And this
is approximations to the physics, I see, okay.
Yes.
Question about the data analysis. Since you only have a 0.1 second time to analyze the data, how does this affect the issue of noise subtraction? You have to subtract the noise to get the result.
So what by noise subtraction, if you mean that if I took whatever my best matching data is and I subtracted the noise, what is left is that residual consistent, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a short time.
Yes.
With us compared yes. to the other LIGO results.
That is very correct. That is very correct. So what
you need to be careful.
So what we did as a consistency test, and I'll just bring it to the next slide here, the consistency with GR. So this model is a reflect, is in some sense, the solution that we get from our theory. And whatever best matching sort of solution is, it's actually a family of, we get a 90% confidence band of all possible solutions to these models. And we subtracted it from the data at the time when this event sort of comes. And then what we are left with is a residue, and we try to find a signal to noise ratio of this residue. Does that have any leftover physics that we have not captured? And the residue that is left is consistent with just the typical background noise that LIGO has when there is no event. We have only done tests a few seconds around this signal. If there are, these echoes that the parameter group has been very heavily involved with, when those happens at a different timestamps, we have not looked at it. That kind of test has not been done on this event. So it is possible to get some inference of non-GR physics. We have only considered this model, subtracted with the residue, and seen what is left. And that is consistent with noise. The signal to noise ratios are consistent with noise. The morphology left over is also just background noise.
But the result is still more dependent. Since you're comparing with models, it's not the raw data.
Yes, that is correct. But the signal to noise ratio that we get is still relatively higher compared to other black holes that we have confirmed with LIGO. So the signal to noise ratio is still almost 2/3 of what the first gravitational wave detection was.
Could I ask on this topic about certainty of the detection, since it's such a small fragment of a gravitational wave template, and since it's at low frequencies, I guess one might worry that it's maybe related to an unusual seismic event. Did you check whether there was anything unusual going on seismically that day?
Yeah, so we had a full green signal from the detector characterizations. That there was nothing particularly of particularly seismic noise that would, or a blip glitch that would stand out. In fact, when I was at LIGO Livingston, we had conducted studies that we will do a hardware injection of 800 solar mass black holes, much heavier than this. It was actually an SXS simulation that we had a hardware injection on. And even at that 800 solar mass, the way the mirrors move with the hardware, and we allowed our online search pipelines, those very burst pipelines, to find it. And it was still able to see that the signal is different than the background data. So we've had a series of checks before even we reached the third observing run that anything of this mass comes. So the detector frame mass is roughly around 300 solar masses, as here you can see on the x-axis. And that mass we can see in the data at low frequencies.
And to what extent does that sort of test rely on using, extrapolating theoretically what the probability distribution of rare seismic events is to larger events than we actually see? Or to what extent is it sort of using a well-measured probability distribution of seismic events at those frequencies that are of a size that we do actually see?
So when we do this closed box studies, before we sort of open the box and say, whether there is a gravitational wave event or not, those closed box studies have already looked at, all the any sort of glitch that appears. The search algorithms have been tuned to already neglect any morphology that is standard with a background glitch, and after that we have this open box result, and anything that remains, is something if it's coincident in three detectors at the same time, it has a very narrow chance of it being associated with any glitch, particularly at that frequency, a seismic glitch. Does that answer, Lathan?
I think yes. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
All of this gets us back to getting another event or two to be convinced.
Yes, and I'll have a slide right after that for that. Actually, let me just skip the ring down part, because that is something which is fairly understood, how we do the consistency test between what we have seen pre-merger and post-merger. Now, in the data that is available to public...
Do you mind actually saying what the ring down consistency was?
Yeah, all right.
Sorry.
So this time we had the signal is, a lot of SNR is actually the ring down, because the signal is sort of short. We had observed our mode, and from there we are able to give a what is the mass of the black hole in the detector frame, because ring down is does not know what the distance is. And we were able to also measure, get some bounds on spins, but it's fairly broad, it's just a mode. We did it with multiple different modes, including only the 2-2 modes or having additional modes. All these gray lines are ring down analysis. And the colored contours are the three waveform models that we had used to predict what the in-spiral parameters is. Then based on the simulations that are this phenomenological fit, and these are really, the fits, that you have a collection of NR simulations that tell you what the pre to post-merger remnant properties is. We use those fits and predict what the final remnant merger is. We get roughly, they overlap. And that overlap is, our consistency test of GR. It's not any incredible test, because the system is fairly broad here, the contours, but we see that there is no certain violation. So that is what we have seen. And this is consistent with past LIGO events as well. So there's nothing new here. The only new thing is we have seen at a very different mass scale than what we had seen in past.
Okay.
Yeah. But it does also, you know, raise the confidence that this thing is a real event, right? You know, because this test could have been failed.
That's very true, yes. So this test does increase our confidence that this is a binary black hole merger. Otherwise, this is hard to sort of make it work, you know, all the way. This is actually a good way, yes, you said, and it's a good way for us to be confirmed about the astrophysical origin of it. That we don't know whether if it's, you know, head-on collision, because head-on collision would still have ring down, whether it's a different mass ratios than what we had predicted, because it would still be consistent, more or less, what we have seen here. But we can at least say that this is a black hole, black hole. Right. So now to the question of, this is rare, this by itself is fairly unique, but in the open data that LIGO publishes, that now independent groups sort of are open to, you know, have their own search algorithms find and analyze events. And it shows a maturity in the field that A, we are doing this, B, there are all of this are journal publications, so it is being accepted by the larger community, that we don't need to have a LIGO Virgo stamp on every gravitational wave study. Here is a plot of things that have been published, which are heavy. The three here, blue lines, are the heaviest LIGO events, excluding this particular discovery. The orange contour that you see is from the Princeton group. They have their own search algorithm and they do their analysis. They find a black hole, which is roughly about 100 solar mass as the remnant, what is left. At least one of the primary black holes is in this pair instability mass gap limit. And there was another black hole, another such catalog actually was published by the Syracuse group and the Albert Einstein group. It is, you can see, is the yellow contour. Again, you know, there's a, you know, the final black hole is roughly around 120. So both the primary and secondary black hole, or at least one of them, are in the gap. The black contour here is one of the LIGO-Virgo triggers that we knew, but it was sub-threshold trigger. It did not have the false alarm probability that we can quote it as astrophysical. So with one of my undergraduate students, we analyzed what the parameters of the signal could be, assuming this is astrophysical. And we roughly get the parameters very consistent with what this particular discovery is. We get the primary black hole mass is around 90 solar mass. Secondary black hole is about 60 solar mass. So at least primary is very much in the gap again. It's very far. The distance is almost, you know, redshift of 1.3, but it's also fairly broad because again, it's a short signal. We don't have much inference of it. But there is an emerging population. I'm not talking, and this is not even O3 events. They're all past O1, O2 events. There have been instances, but this, what LIGO discovery marked was the first confirmed case, yes, that there is a population of heavier black holes of this sort. Now, there is a particular trend that we see about these massive black holes, which could be informative about the origins. Like, one thing is, if you plot the spins of all the LIGO black holes that we have seen, and also include this last particular one, an open gravitational wave trigger, and the violin plot here is actually all the 13-ish LIGO or 14 LIGO events. The y-axis is a spin parameter. It's not really addition of two spin. It's more like decomposing in the projections and then adding all the projections. It's a sort of emergent spin parameter. Unfortunately, I don't have a formula here with me. But a trend that you can see is all the blue comp violin plots that I've had is referring to a very heavy mass event. So this one is 150, this one is again 150, this one is about 90. And rest of all LIGO Virgo black holes are at least below 50% of what this parameter can be. So there is some inference that wherever they are originating from, their progenitor black holes seems to be very highly spinning. And that is again an additional check for if they are this hierarchical mergers. So one black hole finds another black hole. After that has merged, the merged black hole always roughly has a 60 to 70% spinning, even if it's two non-spinning black holes that have formed a final black hole, because the angular momentum is being transferred into final product. So that is something we still see in all of these massive events. Again, so it's only three.
Can you explain again, what's the difference between gray and yellow and red?
Yes. So the gray are all LIGO events. The yellow are the LIGO events that seems to be very highly spinning, but they are not massive. The red are the ones that are massive.
Red are massive and highly spinning, they're saying.
Okay. Massive and also happen to be highly spinning. So the fact that they are highly spinning is coincident, but they are massive for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If they had been that massive but less highly spinning, would that have pushed their characteristic ring down frequency lower so that maybe it would be harder for LIGO to have detected them? I just intuitively think about the fact that the higher spinning it is, the smaller the ISCO gets, and smaller the light ring gets, and maybe that makes that pushes it to higher frequency the event at a given mass.
So if it was, let's say, like this spinning, and so the frequency would be even smaller versus this, that would be spinning a little higher. So we don't find actually evidence of either. We find it this way, the spins are, at least of the pregenitor black holes, but them itself are spinning fairly fast. So the merger frequency is very second order effect, right? With the in-plane component of the spins.
Okay.
But what I'm saying here is that even if it's in plane, it is spinning fast. Not necessarily the fact that they are aligned with the momentum.
Okay.
The effective spin, chi effective, is equal to the weighted spin dotted into the overangular momentum. And there are two possibilities. You can have a small spin and misalignment of the spins, or a large spin and no misalignment. So how does this work out here?
So chi effective, John, still works out to be close to zero, and that is true for roughly almost everything that I've plotted here.
Everything.
Chi effective is very zero. Chi P is a little broad. It has this peak around 0.6 for actually all three of them. So we see that it has in-plane spins. The chi BBH here is, you can think of it as some sort of a linear combination of chi effective plus chi P, plus what the internal spin magnitudes are and how they, you know, the azimuthal component adds up.
So you're sure that the spin is high?
Inferences, you know, again, you know, this is...
How inference is this?
The median values of the posterior are high. Let me put that way. So under 90% confidence, you know, the spins is very, very broad. I mean, this is as good as saying, you know, it could be non-spinning. It's not non-spinning. It can be like greater than 0.2 or 0.3.
Sorry, so these two events, 0729 and 0502, these two events are the substratial events?
Yes, so 0502 is this particular event at about 150 solar masses, and the 07029 is this blob that you see around at 90 solar mass.
So if the signal-to-noise ratio for these two events are low, then you would expect wider spin distribution, right?
So the signal-to-noise ratio at which LIGO right now sees spins are very broad. Unless and until it's, the reason you see in this particular case that this distribution is much tighter compared to, you know, almost everything else is because this was a mass ratio 4 or 5. So we had a much longer orbit and it had this mass ratio difference. So we were able to break the spin degeneracy better. At least, you know, it's only really the primary black hole spin that it matters. All others are very equal mass events. And that's why it becomes even tighter to constrain the spins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I think it's still difficult to claim that the heavier one have higher spins because these two events are substratial events. So it's possible that they're not.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. So we need, right now we are only playing with, you know, a couple of few dozen numbers, less than a few dozen. So by the time the second or third catalog is published, which would be at least 40 more events on top of this, then we will have some distribution of spin, which is more stronger. All right. So I'll rush a little quick now in interest of time, but one thing I'll just go back to the fact that, you know, gravitational wave measurement is essentially luminosity distance and redshifted mass. You know, we don't know what the astrophysical mass of the black holes is. We assume a certain cosmology and then infer what the astrophysical mass is. Now, assuming there is a pair instability mass gap, that suppose black holes cannot be greater than 60 solar masses, or they cannot be or somewhere between 60 and 120, there is a complete prohibition zone. So now, depending on what cosmology I choose, my redshifted mass is different, because if I use the Planck cosmology with a smaller H naught, I find the system is closer. If I use the supernova cosmology, I find the black holes to be, you know, farther and farther, I mean in redshift, not in luminosity distance. So the higher the redshift, the smaller the mass would happen. And so you can see here, these are all these sort of heavy mass LIGO black holes that I've plotted. Based on whether I choose Planck or choose cosmology, the posterior sort of shifts between the two. Now, we can use this inference to reverse and say that, assuming the pair instability starts at 60, can we constrain H naught? Now, this is not a very tight constraint. This is not like having a multi-messenger signal and then you have overlap. Very broad constraint, but can we learn anything about H naught? So what we have done here in this upcoming study is we took this particularly heavy event and then we took other black hole events. We tried to combine what we get in inference of H naught, assuming a gap starts at 60. And this is a big assumption because we don't know if it's a 55 or 75. Assuming it starts here, there is a particular preference it has for the supernova cosmology. And that is to do really with the construction, because we want the black holes to be smaller. So it always favors a higher H naught. If we have multiple such events, then we can do better statistics out of it. This is a very independent way. You know, you don't need any galaxy association. You don't need any electromagnetic counterpart. And all of them are at high redshifts. You know, all these inferences that we get. So we get to learn. I'm not going to claim that this is a way that is going to revolutionize anyway, but we can probe Hubble constant this way, or alternatively, we can probe mass gap this way. So if you think that Planck is the only correct result and all this pick has to line up with Planck, that means my mass gap has to be much higher. And so vice versa, we can have this sort of an observational constraint on either pair instability or H naught. If no question, I'll move through the very last part now, which is how this particular discovery, and this especially I'm very interested, opens the science case for building new gravitational wave facilities. So LIGO is almost like what equivalent of COBE is, right? I mean, we have, this is our first experiment. We see that there is things exist in the universe. We learn something. Then we need better instruments to probe it with a higher accuracy resolutions, or, you know, different frequency spectrum. So here, what I've plotted here is the detection radius. This is how an instrument, how far the instrument can see. And that is a function of black hole mass or frequency. So you can, it's a one-to-one correspondence. I've plotted here as black hole masses. The green contour here is our LIGO at its design sensitivity. So within a few years, this is what LIGO is going to be. It's actually very close to it already now. We can see up to 1,000 solar mass black holes. We can see roughly up to redshift 2. And this is the best the detector can see. You know, already the GW19-521 is roughly sitting here within this contour. This is not an astrophysical distribution. This is what the detectors can see. If we build next generation facilities, which are going to be this 40 by 40 kilometer LIGO, or, you know, this Einstein telescope, which is a LIGO-like setup, but triangle and inside underground, we can start seeing binary black hole mergers almost up to redshift 100. We don't expect anything beyond redshift 40. But the very fact that the detector can probe, you know, almost dark ages, you know, that is just incredible. The thing I'm most interested in is what we can probe in the intermediate mass black hole range. Because if 150 exist, does 300 exist? Does 1,000 exist? Does 10,000 exist? And are all of them same sort of starting progenitor channels? Or is it like two different channels that are somewhere creating the smaller, lighter black intermediate mass black hole and the other higher intermediate mass black holes? So in this whole range of IMBH from about, you know, pair instability to, let's say, 100,000 solar mass, you can already see all detectors would cover it very well. And in fact, every time we improve low frequency, we go at higher and higher total mass to probe intermediate mass black holes. The real game changer is going to come when LISA flies. It's going to be a few million kilometer arm length satellite in space. The distance with which LISA can probe ion VHS is unprecedented. Only CMB experiments can probe universe at a further distance than this. We don't expect, again, ion VHS this far. But the very fact that detectors have sensitivity to see recombination dark ages and all this era gives us a very promising reason to have future gravitational wave facilities, even for the known sources that exist here. Once LISA flies, a particularly interesting science case opens, because let's say this signal we saw is only 0.1 seconds. So what we saw here, and this is a typical way we show gravitational wave plots, so there's a characteristic strain versus frequency. We saw merger and ring down about 0.1 seconds. You know, that's all roughly we caught. But the binaries are merging for millions of years, and LISA starts capturing a few years before of their merger. So it sees in spiral for a few years, 4 to 10 years. So everything that we cannot say right now about spin, about eccentricity, about distance, LISA would know with an accuracy which is much broader than any of other ground detectors combined, just because the length of the data is now 4 to 10 years. It's also a very unique way to test GR, because we see in spiral the pre-merger properties in a different way, the post-merger property in a completely independent way, and we can sort of have this multi-wavelength gravitational wave astronomy, analogous to, you know, looking at an electromagnetic picture of, you know, source through radio, through X-ray, through UV, and we learn different physics at the different instances. That is the same we expect here with gravitational wave astronomy once LISA flies. Regardless of whatever experiment is on ground, that is a confirmed science going to happen. This was published recently, this multiband, it was a cover of Nature Astronomy. I'm happy to discuss more interesting tests of GRs that we can do and the astrophysical channels we can do with it. I'll move on right now. And the last part is we want to really detect ion VHS, but we want to do slightly more. We want to also study, you know, the dark sector as well as we can, because the sources can be seen so far. This can be linked to primordial black holes. So we have proposed a particular detector that we can build on the moon. The moon is, of all things that you can do as astronomy, gravitational waves is the most natural thing you can do on the moon, because it's seismically quiet. It's at least 3 orders of magnitude quieter than Earth. It is a natural vacuum, so you don't need to build these tunnels. And it has no environmental or human noise, which is a very strong factor that affects your gravitational wave measurements on Earth. Now, the thing to compete against is why you go on moon when you could have space satellites, but the space satellites are only a few year long. So we wait 30 years to build LISA, and LISA is going to run for 4 to 10 years. And that's all our science data is. Compared to LIGO, is running since 2000, and it's still running, and it's going to go on for another 20 years. So stable base is always much more beneficial than space satellites. They also probe very different frequency regimes, so we are not really competing. But we submitted this proposal to the SNOMAS exercise. You know, many of you are from the particle physics community may be aware here. The SNOMAS is the US equivalent, the DOE equivalent of the NASA Decadal Survey. They collect, you know, what are the things which we want to do for particle physics in the next 10 years. We had submitted this, strong support from the community because of the science cases. Interestingly, DOE also wants that we partner with NASA for interesting moon-based experiments. There is a much more DOE interest to have an energy sector from the moon. NASA Artemis is a very much, you know, going forward. We are gearing up there. We have also submitted this proposal to NASA Artemis. One of the main source of Artemis is they want to build a base at the same spot in the moon, go there repeatedly. And they want to have a science case of what we can do other than build a human base. And one of the top priorities of the science is observing the universe from a unique location. So that is what we are, you know, trying to champion here for Gravitational Wave Observatory. European Space Agency is also sending a large lander. We are coordinating with them also for a proposal. That is, again, this is much more in future. If it happens in my lifetime, I'll be happy. But this is things which we are, as a community, proposing. I'll skip this. We can chat about it, you know, what all cosmology and especially particle physics that we can do from the moon. There is a lot of science case, especially calibrating type 1A supernovae and et cetera. So I'll come back now to the present world, is GW1905-21 origins. From one event, and I'm going to skip all the other smaller events, that the less confident events that we have seen, I'm just sticking with this one event. Is this astrophysical? And if it is, what else it can be? So let's say it starts from stellar origins. Suppose stars don't go through pair instability supernova. There is a way to completely avoid this. If you match with the star formation rate, if you take into account the initial mass function and the stars that need to produce an 80-90 solar mass black hole, and you match with the LIGO observing rate, you get that only less than 0.8% of stars can make this kind of black holes. So the direct stellar origin is a bit tricky here to match with the system. Can this be hierarchical binary black hole mergers like the one that I've been talking about? The challenge here is that every time two black holes merge, it has a recoil velocity, and that recoil velocity depends on the spins of the two black holes. So if you have this kind of a case that we had seen for this event, and we actually have given the numbers, we think that the black hole that has formed after this merger has been kicked by at least 1500 kilometers per second. If that kind of recoil velocity is there, it is very unlikely a globular cluster is able to keep them glued. So let's say if you say that, oh, you've seen 150, would you see a 300 the same way? Very unlikely if it is a hierarchical mergers. It's very spin sensitive, but you cannot rule it out right now. If young globular clusters had stellar mergers, that is able to sort of prevent this pair instability mass gap and unknown physics, a lot of it there. Different models predict that it could be 2% of all black holes in globular clusters can be in the gap. Accretion is one way that you increase the mass of the black hole. It has formed small, but over the time has increased. AGN disk is what has been claimed as an electromagnetic counterpart. Now, this is a very testable model, because even if you don't see electromagnetic counterparts, if every LIGO black hole has a sky map and a distance contour, ellipsoid, in which you, if you keep finding AGN, then it increases some statistical relevance of saying that, oh, this is coming from an AGN versus it coming from a global cluster, something that can be tested. In the exotic channels, can this be completely non-binary black hole and a core collapse supernovae? Unlikely, because A, the morphology is different, but B, for the amplitude of the signal that we have seen, if it's coming from a core collapse supernovae, we would have also seen neutrinos. We did not see them, so we can fairly rule them out. We have looked at more exotic cosmic strings. The data actually does not support that at all. We have not looked at beyond GR, but if there is, echoes or any such post-ring down effect that tells us something unique about its origin, I'm really happy to chat about it. There's things that it can be given an upper limits to. We have also ruled out gravitational lensing just purely from the distance that we have seen and the optical density that would be assumed in that kind of a case. What we cannot rule out is primordial or POP3 black hole mergers. One way to rule them out is through spins. Primordial black holes are not predicted to be highly spinning unless, from some reason of accretion, they have changed or their course over the time. That is our way to probe. We have not seen events far away. If we start seeing the same event at redshift 3, redshift 5, then we can be more confident about the primordial origins of this. Can this be a highly eccentric collision? Literally two black holes collided and formed. Astrophysically, it doesn't make sense. But there has been multiple studies by independent groups, actually by colleagues at LIGO, who claim that the data is more favorable to eccentric collision than circular binary. So we did not test eccentric models because eccentricity is very challenging to include in our analysis. And also from an astrophysical point of view, all LIGO events are roughly zero eccentricity because they've lost eccentricity as gravitational waves unless there is a perturber. They claim the data is more consistent with eccentric collision. A big reason then, consequence of it, is that if it's an eccentric merger, that means it is less energetic than a circular merger. So the system has to be much closer away to us to have created this event. And in their analysis, they find this 2.5 gigaparsec association with AGN consistent with an eccentric merger. Possibility, hard to claim right now with one event. Only yesterday a study came that says that this is an intermediate mass ratio binary. that this can be 120 solar mass with a 30 solar mass, completely different mass ratio that they predict. I cannot comment on them. It's just that whatever we have looked, our models are, have seen up to mass ratio 10, and we don't see much evidence. But again, this is all just the start. What is interesting is that in the next 10 to 20 years, no matter what telescope of gravitational wave is working, whether it's LIGO, whether it's LISA, whether it's Moon or anything in between, all of them can see this 100 to 1,000 solar mass intermediate mass black holes, the slight intermediate mass black holes. And we will be able to test all of the origin stories. If we are able to check many of them, not many gravitational wave sources are like this. If you had a binary neutron star, LISA cannot see it, space detectors cannot see it. So it's only really IMBHs that are really at the sort of center of our gravitational wave revolution. And so I hope you all are convinced as well why they are so interesting. Thank you again for being so patient and listening to me and having me over. Thanks.
Okay, great. So we are over time, so let's stop here. So Karan has indicated that he's happy to hang out and chat with people. So please stay on if you have questions for him. So let's thank him for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.